Welcome to Explain to Shane. I'm your host, Shane Tews at the American Enterprise Institute. On this podcast, I interview tech industry experts to explain how the apps, services, and structures of today's information technology system work and how they shape our social and economic life. Last year, there were over 880 million cybercrime complaints, resulting in over $12 billion in losses. Cybercriminals have successfully targeted and stolen data from major companies across industries, from retailers like Target to entertainment giants like Sony and healthcare providers like Anthem. The scope and scale of these attacks continues to grow. Analysts say cybercrime is the third largest economy in the world, right after the United States and China. Behind the scene, managing the aftermath of these attacks are skilled cybersecurity experts and industry veterans who are working to protect organizations and individuals from the growing tide of sophisticated cyber attacks. To help us understand this critical work, I am joined by industry expert Jason Hogg. Jason serves as executive in residence at Great Hill Partners, where he focuses on fintech and cybersecurity insurance. Prior to this position, Jason was an executive for Upbound Group and an executive vice president of the Akima business line, where he is the inventor of the Akima ecosystem platform, which provides tech-based consumer solutions for the unbanked and underbanked. Prior to his corporate career, Jason served as a special agent with the FBI. Join me as Jason and I discuss the importance of encouraging everyone to have a data security mindset as we manage the staggering growth of cybercrime in today's economy. Jason, thank you for being a guest today on Explain to Shane. You have done some really fascinating work, and you know, I can't wait to have this conversation because I feel like as someone who's been in the outer edges of cybersecurity, not in the core as you've been, I've had the same conversations multiple times about, you know, how important it is. So I'm looking forward to digging deeper into this. So to get us started, tell us a little bit about your background and what got you into this and what you're doing currently.
Yeah, really, first and foremost, appreciate the opportunity to come on. So thank you very much. And I'll try and sum up 30 years plus quickly. It's getting more difficult.
Highlights, get the highlights.
Yep, as the years go on. But I've been an entrepreneur and an intrapreneur in everything from started a company out of my garage, which I sold to American Express, to being a C-level exec at places like American Express, Blackstone, Aon, as examples. I'm a former special agent. I have 600 issued patent claims. A lot of it is in the space of fraud prevention, machine learning, cyber diagnostic, risk assessment, mitigation, and stuff. So, been in multiple industries: insurtech, fintech, banking, and technology. So, have been able to watch it over the course of my career as cyber has continued to persist from a threat perspective.
That's a good 30 years. That's awesome. And you didn't mention which agency. Is it okay for you to tell us which agency you were in?
I was a special agent with the FBI. I was in the FBI's Special Operations Group 13. So we did covert operations.
So you have lots of things you can't tell us. That's right. Fascinating. Right. We will not be talking about that today, but I wish we could. You think at this stage we wouldn't be having more data breaches than historically, you know, at least the ones we know about, which is part of the problem, right? Because of the reporting requirements. But we are just having an incredible amount of data breaches. And where do you recommend we start on a healing path? Because I feel like there's so many places to go, and the technical people probably have some very good ideas, but I feel like the biggest challenge are those who really aren't technical. So I'm thinking C-suite and, you know, above. And I always give this kind of conversation where I'm like, if you don't like your IT guy, go find a guy you like that you can have a really candid conversation with. Because I feel like that's part of the problem is the IT guy is going, I've been trying to tell you this is a problem. And, you know, they go spend money on something else other than IT. So what are your recommendations when you walk in? You know, you kind of give us the step-by-step. You go in, somebody's had a cyber breach. Where do you even start?
Yeah. So a couple things in there, sort of taking a step back quickly. You know, obviously, the biggest thing has been you've got three big trends that are taking place as the Internet of Things continues to proliferate. Mobility specifically also proliferates. And then you also have essentially free data storage, which, you know, was something that has caused all of us to just aggregate up more. And then social media continuing to proliferate and people putting everything online. So what you've effectively done is you've increased the attack surface tremendously for the fraudsters. So that's the first thing. So that's going to be growing. And then with machine learning, as an illustrative example, that's been coming on, and generative AI and everything, you're also opening up all new tools to get access to new attack vectors and ways to get after that bigger landscape to go after for cyber criminals, to go after businesses and consumers. So then, in answer to your question with regard to, you know, what do you do or where do you start? I think the first thing is that there needs to be a fundamental shift in the mindset. You know, I remember when I took over as CEO of Aon Cyber Solutions back in 2015, and we used to have this annual report that would talk about our predictions for the future. And in the report, it said that we would end up having $1 billion worth of cyber crime. And I ended up saying to myself, wow, that seems like a staggering number. And interestingly, now, if you look at the FBI's latest figures on it in their cyber crime incident reporting, it was $1.6 billion. And now, as of about a year or so ago, it's $6.8 billion. And yet we just continue to march on, you know, boiling frog syndrome, like nothing's happening with these eye popping things. So I think a mindset shift, Shane, really needs to take place, and we need to get our head out of the sand and stop being cyber ostriches, basically.
I love that idea, because that is that perfectly gives you a visual. I saw a deck recently, PowerPoint deck, and somebody was saying that the cyber criminal activity is the third largest economy in the world behind the US and China. And that to me is an awakening moment. That's like when you realize the bad guys are not only really bad, they're very good at being bad. And yep. So if you don't have your defenses up as well as your offenses, right, you know, they are just coming towards you. I mean, don't think you've been hacked, you know, you're just being naive about it. But it's also that it's just a matter of time, because, you know, it's just such a target rich environment. So let's break this down to a couple of things you mentioned in the beginning. So cloud compute made storage feel free. Now it's maybe come up a little bit in expense, but I get your point that people just decided, like, I don't need to curate because I can keep it all. Yep. And that happens. It seems to be a part of the problem is I just call it, like, it's like cyber bloat, or, you know, hoarding. There's just this massive hoarding, because there's a certain stage, you know, and you mentioned social, I want to say stumbled upon it, but it's like they were onto something, and then it just became bigger and bigger, and they could just sell every bit and bite of everything that you did online. And part of that is the the privacy settings, but the wrapper that, you know, just basically says you are now on my platform and everything that you do here is mine, you know, and we're going to sell to whoever we want. And obviously it's there. People don't necessarily they don't like the outcome of that. And there are ways to change that in the settings, even though that tends to be sometimes 2, 3, 16 steps inside to the process. So let's talk about it from the start with the C-suite. So what do you need to say to somebody who's in a position of both power and finances to say, get real about this, start spending money to secure your data, and it's important?
You know, normally I think one of the things that too many C-suite members do is they task it, right? And then what ends up happening is the CISO, or in the case that you were talking about, the IT person, is then tasked with the responsibility of trying to manage across so many different ecosystems and colleagues and politics and everything, versus having direct involvement from the top of the C-suite. That's the first thing. The second thing is that they definitely need to remain involved throughout the process and set a mandate, so that there's sort of an unrestricted approach towards testing vulnerability. You know, ultimately, it's the thing that most quickly evaporates enterprise value in a company. If you want to just destroy enterprise value, get a major cyber breach, and you literally can have billions of dollars just disappearing for shareholders. And so if you really embrace that, and you have a C-suite approach to it and their direct involvement, you should be, if you're a member of that C-suite, telling the people that either are conducting red teaming or penetration testing or assessment of the vulnerabilities of the company to have an unrestricted approach. You would want to actually understand warts and all what's happening in your organization so that you can then address it. There are no politics at the CEO level, right? In the sense to say he has the responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders, the board, and also to his employees to make sure that they're doing everything they can to understand where their vulnerabilities are. If you don't do that, for starters, it's very tough to then actually remediate things.
So you made the comment about cyber ostrich. So just pull that apart for me. How's it? What's going on there? Everybody's just head in the sand.
Yeah, I mean, to the point where when we would come in and let's say we had a diagnostic tool that I invented at Aon called PsyQ, which uses NIST framework and other best practices to quantitatively assess things, I literally would have C-suite executives on more than one occasion at Fortune 500 companies do one of these. They would close their eyes, put their hands over their ears, almost as a visceral reaction to some of the things that they were hearing. Conversely, we had a Fortune 500 CEO that was highly engaged and involved and actually challenged us, said, do your worst. And we did. And we actually were able to infiltrate their network, but it was took an effort and it exposed a vulnerability that was much better to expose to the people who you are paying to help you rather than to leave a door open, so to speak, to your house.
So let's talk about chain of custody of information, because that seems to be a problem too. And a lot of these incidents seem to have subcontractor issues.
One of the biggest concerns that we've seen over and over again is we're conducting everything from penetration testing, red teaming, to tabletop exercises, is that the third-party providers are, while there may be a contractual obligation that they have to undergo certain testing and maintain certain standards, what really effectively is happening is they're not part of these penetration tests and they're not part of these red teams. And so by extension, you're not actually testing your entire ecosystem if you're not going straight at them and including them in that process. And so you're spot on in that it's a major exposure. And, you know, when you look at some of the recent breaches like United Health one, you know, in order to create less friction for consumers, in order to have better products, to have better information sharing, better patient care in that particular case, you have this incredibly diverse ecosystem of providers to facilitate transactions, prescriptions, health records, et cetera. But if you're not taking a holistic approach towards testing them and then assessing their vulnerabilities holistically, you're really giving yourself a false sense of security. And that's part of putting your head in the sand, thinking that just testing yourself is doing enough and it's going to get the result that you hope to mitigate risk.
That's a great point. The other thing, and this definitely is something that the U.S. government is trying to do, but I could see why this would work for corporations, is what I call its policy through procurement, which is they, rather than actually having a real policy of this, they just start kind of putting it into the contractual and it's a way to do it, but it isn't always, it's kind of opaque in the way that it moves forward, that you have to make sure that everybody's read those contracts and you can kick them out if they're doing bad things. But by then the biggest bad thing might have already happened, which is maybe what just happened with United Healthcare.
Take United Healthcare aside and just talking generally, I think that the band-aid fix that gives everyone a false sense of security is putting indemnifications in or shifting liability. But at the end of the day, if your customers have been adversely and materially affected and your shareholders are affected by the resulting hit to your stock price or the enterprise value, no one really cares about the indemnification when your brand, reputation, and your consumers have all been exposed, right? So it sort of feels good on the front end, but on the back end, it doesn't really do much for you, right? Other than from a legal perspective, potentially with regard to financial claims.
So let's talk about some of the work you've done in the financial center, because the financial area, because it seems like they are getting it more right than maybe some of the other industry verticals. And part of that is because they're definitely exposure at multiple levels. One of them is an extremely, you know, financial exposure. But is there something that we can learn from how the financial industry has embraced? I mean, even the simple things, two-factor auth, you know, they just, there's a lot of things that they basically, you don't get to touch your own money unless you get through their guardrails, which, you know, is the, you know, I would say it, the clever will figure a way around it, but it'll stop the stupid, you know, it's sometimes the easiest things. But are there any lessons learned there we should be thinking about?
I think there's tremendous lessons, because when you think about cybercrime and its infancy, and even within the up to the past 5 years, the financial sector was the primary attack surface, and people were going straight at bank accounts in ways, whether it be phishing scams, and then those evolved into ransomware and other direct cyber hacks themselves. And so as a result of having been under attack all the way back to the 80s, when you think about credit card fraud, before they had holograms on cards and so on and so forth, they've had to contend with fraud and what evolves from fraud in the payments ecosystem into cyber crime. And so there's a whole series of things that I would say boils down to end to end. So they're looking at from the moment that they get someone, whether it's, you know, let's call it a consumer in this particular instance, account opening, making sure they are who they are. And like you're talking about, knowledge-based authentication, you mentioned multi-factor authentication, ways to make sure that the person is who the person is. But then because of machine learning, because of all the information that's out there through social media, you have the ability to really create sophisticated phishing schemes, right? And so you can't just stop at opening, because there's a lot of social engineering that can occur to open something fraudulently. So once you're through that, you have to continuously monitor behavior, right? So it's everything from account takeovers, so looking at the biometric behavior on someone's phone, to how they transact. Is this a traditional transaction or is this some other type of transaction? And then risk rating it using machine learning to actually put a risk to it. So you're not slowing things down with a bunch of false positives, but rather saying, hey, look, this looks really risky. Let's ask this person to call in, or let's ask this person for more authentication. And then all the way then to the back end, to, you know, whether it's a merchant or wherever the transaction's happening, is to make sure that you're doing the same thing in the ecosystem, to making sure that it's a valid merchant, that the goods and services are, you know, as advertised.
So security by design seems to be a key element there, is just really thinking through it beginning to end, you know, how information is going to be utilized, accessed, you know, what you even just decide to record.
And cross-pollinating, right, Shane, because a lot of the stuff that I just mentioned, it's easily applicable into a whole host of things, ranging from social media to healthcare and industry and you know, a lot of the IoT aspects as well. So taking these best practices and migrating them over in insurtech, as an example, into these other sectors, as they're now getting attacked a lot more and they're becoming more sophisticated from a consumer interface perspective.
So getting away from enterprise, but to some consumer concerns. So I'm the mobile device, which is my favorite thing in the whole wide world. The Europeans just recently passed the Digital Markets Act. And I, you know, I want to be an optimist and say this isn't, they didn't mean to do this, but they're about ready to break some really sophisticated security elements on the system by insisting on interoperability, which is pulling down the guards around like the Apple App Store. I mean, one thing we know about Android is it's a less expensive model because they don't go through a lot of the security testing. And you know more about this, you know, than I do, but I've been reading about it for years. And I'm very concerned because so much of my information, I mean, almost everything that is on my computer more or less is also on my phone. And the idea of breaking down those security measures, I find very concerning that we're taking, that's a huge step backwards. Now, right now it may be contained to Europe, but I kind of doubt it. I think once, you know, people tend to do whatever's going to be the most financially easy thing for them to do. And they're not going to build two systems, right? They're not going to build a European system and then a system for the rest of the world. So am I lost in my thoughts there? Or is this a concern that I should be worried about? Is everything's, and you know, as you mentioned, like everything is mobile is one of the more reasons why there's also a continued data collection. So the amount of data that's getting collected on the mobile device is, especially on consumers, is exceptionally high.
Yep. No, you're right. I mean, it's staggering, actually, the amount of information that can be gleaned and is gleaned and then, you know, stored on top of that for future use and analysis. And I agree with you. I think that it needs to be very thoughtful. Just breaking down, like you said, that barrier can be very dangerous if it's not well thought through and that sufficient time isn't provided in order to really think through the ramifications. The benefits of closed ecosystems, and you mentioned the app stores and the illustrative example, is that you have control and is that you're able to let people into the gates, so to speak. And it's actually a multi-walled type of a citadel so that they go and they test, understand what the app is. There's a review of the app and the app can be populated onto the app store. And then it's still controlled afterwards, in the sense that if something malicious is occurring, they can halt it. And so there is a significant concern there. And so you need to make sure that the procedures on how is that going to be monitored, what's going to happen, is obviously well thought through. And then also allowing time for risk mitigation technology to go into place to enable consumers to be able to understand, you know, what their exposure is. And I think that we, as consumers, you know, it was interesting when you look all the way back at the McAfee days, you know, as an illustrative example, everyone wanted their antivirusware on their laptops. And yet now I think that we're much more, from a consumer perspective, laissez-faire about making sure that we're monitoring what's going on our phone and how is it going. And all of those things are available from a host of, you know, from a host of providers, but no one's really taking the time to treat it with the same level of seriousness.
Yeah, it's the when I actually worked for the company that helped introduce two-factor authentication in the early 2000s. And the part of the problem then was we didn't have anybody to play with. So I used to play, you know, like you'd play dollar poker on it because you're like, I have two twos, because there was like nobody to. And then slowly you could get people to do it. But our CEO used to always say, the problem is any point of friction, you know, people will back off. I mean, it's why people right. abandon their virtual, you know, shopping carts. They get friction, they stop. So that ease of use is the other part that I'm very concerned about that this Digital Markets Act is attacking. Is they're saying, this is more of a Google issue, like, you know, the integration of, you know, all the things that I love about Google, the fact that my Google map is right there. I mean, and, you know, they're saying you have to break this and let everybody make a choice what they want to do. You can't just give it to them. And you're like, well, actually, people don't really like choice as much as you think they do. I mean, I love choice, but I also know that I like ease of use and I like it to come out of the box and work. And that is another part of what they're looking to break. So we have a lot of things to look forward to or to see how much that ends in tears. The other thing I'm curious about is just the whole collection of data. Do you think that they have, and they being really enterprises, have learned any lessons about what, you know, is there a reason to put a governor on the amount of information that they should be keeping? And I realize right now that without a fine structure, which is not my favorite way of controlling people, but it seems to work, they just continue to absorb as much information as possible without there being a real reason not to do that.
To agree to the point I made earlier, it's because with, you know, obviously the mass proliferation of cloud computing plus all of the internal capabilities that these enterprises have, the cost of storage has become incredibly cheap. And so I think that in fairness, everyone does a really good job if you think about the enormity of information that they're having to protect on a daily basis, and protecting it. But I do believe that better transparency with regard to what they're storing, how long they store it, I think is also a very important factor, because the more you keep it, the greater the amount of data that can be breached. And so I think that that's super important as well. So yeah, I think it's definitely an ongoing concern. Like you said, though, very interestingly, consumers generally speaking I don't think that they're overly concerned. And from a generational standpoint, things that we would never consider putting online, you know, my kids' generation wouldn't even think twice about putting online and
sharing that information. Yeah.
Yeah. And leaving it, knowing that it's out there. And I don't think that they care because it's just a completely different mindset. So there's somewhere in between, I guess, Shane, is what I would end up saying, right? And making sure that there's transparency. The biggest thing for me is understanding how it's being leveraged. So it's not just the what is being collected, but how it's being leveraged. And, you know, very sophisticated algorithms with regard to targeting, being able to, as we all know, adjust ad serving, content serving, getting down to what they call segment of one, where you can quite literally start to define a profile for an individual so that you're tailoring all of that. And I think that there's nice, I mean, I get on a regular basis, can we collect information so that we can better tailor this ad or whatever it is? And, you know, I click no. Now, it's probably laughable because who knows how much is already collected just by proxy. The other last thing I'd say real quick on this is something to get back to cross-pollinating. When you look at the payment industry, there's a lot of tokenization. And so, you know, actually, you don't, back when, before I founded Revolution Money, you used to have a vertical record, which was here's your account number, and then here's everything we know about that customer organized by the account number. And we re-aggregated things so that it was, here's a number, that's not the account number. And then by proxy, it's associated with the customer's account number, but that account number by proxy is associated with a whole multitude of tables, and you break up the info. So you make it a lot harder for someone to get hold of all your information. And so I think better understanding of how are we doing that in other facets with health records, right? With social media information and so on and so forth would be really helpful to take those best practices and start forcing through some requirements there with de-identification.
Yeah. The disaggregation of data seems to be, and again, it's the, you know, is there, what's the carrot and the stick there? I mean, if you want to be a good corporate citizen, it all makes sense. But if no one's going to kind of make you do it, you're just going to keep grabbing as much information as you possibly can. And then maybe, you know, like I hiding it in the virtual drawers. I feel like
right.
I was talking to a former colleague who actually, when they were trying to figure out how to get a handle of all the, you know, just the flows of money at Twitter when Elon Musk took over, he said, we just found out they had these server farms that they didn't even know. They were just storing information that no one had tapped into from what they could tell for like a minimum of a year. And he was more or less kind of said, what happens if I just pull this cable? Like, what happens if I pull this plug? And if the answer is nothing, then we can probably shut down that entire server, right? You know, like everything about it. And he goes, we saved, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars going around the world and just assessing, like, do we need these? You know, and at some point, probably the answer was yes in the beginning, and then they completely forgot they had them, which I can only imagine how many other companies are doing that. Well, give us some takeaway thoughts. So this has been a lovely conversation. What am I supposed to, what's the next thing I do to, like, you know, should I be looking at people's actually reading terms of service and terms of use, which is impossible? You know, are there better quality entities that I should be engaging with, or am I just leave this up to the pros and you guys are handling it and it's going to get better?
I think that, you know, I would say there's three things. The first thing is it's incumbent on, call it any type of C-suite player, like I said earlier, to get directly involved and actually start asking the tough questions and perform a diagnostic. It's better to understand what your current posture is and then try and address it, even if it's a miserable report that comes out. Don't get that cyber ostrich, you know, syndrome going. Actually fight through that, get the answers, because then you can begin to attack it. So that would be the first thing. I think the second thing is, and I know that you, from past conversations, that you also talk about this, which is, how is the government involved? Because right now there's sort of a self-attestation approach to this, and people are somewhere in the range of spectacular to absolutely abysmal in how they're approaching their cyber posture, and having some type of standards that are not just self-attestation standards, but there's a reporting out. If you're a certain size organization, if you hold certain information outside of the payments industry, because that's highly regulated, what are the types of things that you need to report out on? Not just when something goes wrong, but what your current posture is. And I think that's the second thing. And then the third thing is, from a consumer perspective, like you were talking about, I do think it's having an understanding of what's out there, what have I put out there, and is it necessary, whether it's your server example at Twitter or whether it's your own personal example on how much you're storing, where are you storing it, why are you still storing it, and you know, doing a virtual digital spring cleaning.
Digital cleanse. Love that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it has been lovely to get to talk to you. I hope that we continue to have conversations with you, because I know you're only going to keep us smarter throughout the, as things get unfortunately a little scarier out there, but you can help make it better.
Well,
so thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to have me on. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for being a guest today on Explain to Shane.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Explain to Shane. For more episodes, subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred listening platform. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues to tune in. We'll see you on the next episode of Explain to Shane.